Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Sword and Sandal Cinema. But before we start, I'd like to give you a glimpse into another project, which we're calling for now Sword and Sandal Superheroes, Strange Science and Outer Space. A little bit clunky, but we'll get it right in time. Anyway, the associations between the stories of Olympian mythology and the patterns in the night sky are hoary with age. It is to our credit that millennia later, we still honor the tales immortalized in the starry heavens by our ancestors and continue to add new ones of our own devising. Hercules is banished from Mount Olympus and is bound to travel the vastness of space until such a time as he can learn humility, or so decreed the red-haired Zeus of the Marvel Universe back in the 1980s. And thus began a comedic epic that spanned the decade, courtesy of Bob Layton's cosmic creativity. Driving the sun chariot of Apollo, the Prince of Power went forth into the starry void. In the dawn of his odyssey, the colonizers of Rigel supplied him with a recorder to chronicle his myriad adventures. And what adventures they were! Naught was as it seems, and many a life lesson did the son of Zeus learn. Though he often found himself in trouble, his heroic spirit finally triumphed over all internal and external obstacles. Using a ploy as ancient as Hellas, he even saved the planet from obliteration by making the world eater Galactus laugh over a shared drink. The years passed quickly for a star-spanning hero. Many a tale was sung throughout the cosmos regarding his many astral exploits and bedroom conquests. It is now 2385 of the Common Era. Hercules, still accompanied by the robotic recorder, makes friends with a roguish Skrull, gives his heart to a mortal woman, and starts to age prematurely. With the help of Mentor, ruler of Titan and staunch ally of Zeus, he discovers that all is not well on Olympus. Zeus, in a fit of madness, has slain his kin and has laid waste to his shining kingdom. Though initially reluctant to fight his father, Hercules eventually challenges the Lord of Dark Clouds and triumphs. Before Zeus dies, he oppresses his love for his son and explains that the time has come for him to move on and leave this mortal plane. Hercules is the last of the Olympians. And unfortunately, it took over a decade or so for the story to continue, but now I believe it is finally wrapped up. It's available through back issues and graphic novels. And now onward to Sword and Sandal Cinema. Greetings and welcome, O Sword and Sandal Cinema host. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. Michael is not here yet.
Oh, well. I'm sure he'll be here in a moment.
So Michael, I know, is going to talk about the movie Tut. Is that the same movie that you want to talk about?
Well, I don't want to, but I guess that's what we're going to talk about. Yeah.
Okay, we'll wait for Michael a little bit more, or I'll play a song and try to reach him. Let me see what we
Are you going to play Golden Bough?
Yes, I'll play Golden Bough if you like.
Okay,
you like
great.
That one? Okay,
I love
great.
It.
What path do I be treading?
Greetings and welcome back to Sword and Sandal Cinema. Our hosts are here, so I introduce to you Setna Comwest, also known as Michael K. Waterman, and Diana Montford. Greetings and welcome all hosts.
Hi. Thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to the review of Tuts tonight, so I will hand the scepter over to Setna.
Thank you, and I'm excited to bring this to you. This is a movie that I was reticent to watch. I thought that it was some of the pieces were miscast. King Tut was not a brown-haired or blonde-haired boy. He was a bald-headed, little dark-haired boy. And I was surprised at the casting. Ben Kingsley is amazing as the High Priest Ie, which, by the way, is a past life of mine. So I was very, very pleased that he was playing me. It was an interesting thing. I've had two rather powerful past lives in Egypt that time period. Tutankhamun was about, 65 years before Setna Comwest. So that was kind of an interesting thing. Ie came to the temple, came to the rule of Tutankhamun while he was with Akhenaten. And he was quite old by the time he became the Grand Vizier he had been a pharaoh later after Akhenaten. And he takes this child from a child into a boy king. So it's kind of an interesting thing. We start with Akhenaten being ousted, which is exactly what happened. And we go and we have from 9 years old until 19 years old is the reign of Tutankhamun. And he shows him how it is. The boy was told in so many words, and Diana will back me up, see here, you little bastard. You are not going to have this Aten thing happening anymore. You are going to rule the way we used to rule with the original gods and goddesses of Egypt. King Tut was a little boy, and he said, gasp, sure, I'll do whatever you tell me to, until he reached the age where he felt he could push them around. Diana, how do you feel about this?
Well, I have a huge problem with this film, and here's why. As you mentioned earlier, King Tut is not correctly cast. King Tut was, in fact, a black man. Now, I'm white, but I find the fact that they cast a Mediterranean-looking but clearly Caucasian person as King Tut extremely offensive. I don't think it's right to take away a black hero from the black world and whitewash him. I think, it's just not right that people who have been denigrated for millennia, really, should have one of their few heroes just destroyed. That said, I also don't think that King Tut was all that big a deal. Someone once said that considering King Tut one of the great pharaohs of Egypt is like considering Millard Fillmore one of the great presidents of the U.S. That it was simply a case of, what?
I was going to
what?
Say, I agree with you. I agree with you.
Yes.
I really feel that King Tut was a minor pharaoh, and that should... King Tut was a minor pharaoh and should not have been given all the credit. Yes, his tomb and his death made him famous, but his life, he was rather insignificant.
And he had such a short reign, and he was so concerned with his health problems, which were many, that I don't think he... did a lot for Egypt, and frankly, I am very much opposed to the divine right of monarchs. I believe that that is the most pernicious way of looking at the world and at politics. I think that ultimately, it should be a meritocracy and not, well, I was born, to be ruler because my father and mother were rulers and their fathers and mothers were rulers.
Stop you right there. That was not the case in Egypt. Many, many times in many, many dynasties, the priests and priestesses of Amun and the other gods and goddesses looked at a candidate for pharaoh. And because you were the older son or the older daughter of a pharaoh did not necessarily mean you would rule. If they found, for instance, there was a pharaoh, I think he's Amenhotep II. If they found that he was not helping the kingdom, they were made to abdicate or were not given the privilege of being the governorship. Unfortunately for us, Akhenaten, King Tut's father, was good for the first 4 years of his life, his rule. However, in the last 15 years of his rule, the pharaoh, the priest classes and what have you, had had enough of his ridiculousness with his destroying all the gods and goddesses and destroying all the conventions and culture that Egypt had flourished with.
In other words, excuse me, he made Egypt a monotheistic nation.
It wasn't just that. He also, if you disagreed with him on his choice of art, if you cuisine, costume, what have you, you were immediately killed. Immediately.
Sounds like Donald Trump to me, okay.
Well, I guess there's an interesting comparison in a way. But we're talking about his son, King Tut. And King Tut was not given much of a choice. Amenhotep IV, Akhenaten, didn't have any other male children. And he had Ankhesenamen, his 12-year-old daughter, who was the oldest of Akhenaten's daughters. And they married her to the 9-year-old King Tut. She was, you know, she had no choice either. They were, this is how it was going to be. Horemheb and Ramses I, who was then a general, and Ie, the high priest, all said, sit down, you people. This is how we're going to do this. And then they ruled as regent until King Tut reached about 15. And you'll see this in the movie. He started to be trying to exercise his powers as pharaoh. He wanted to reinstitute Akhenaten's Atenism, the one god piece. The high priest says no. He starts making decrees, which the high priest and the generals say no to. And he becomes annoyed. And so what he starts doing is going hunting and swimming and fishing and all these things that he, as a disabled young man, really couldn't do. We do know that he bounced off of his chariot and did damage his leg. Diana, you mentioned that when we spoke about this movie, that he had many walking sticks.
Mm-hmm. No, which are buried with him, obviously. Now, there is a rumor, which is probably not true, that he was murdered because of a hole in his skull. But that apparently was done when the English people who dug up his tomb dropped him. Is that true?
There are cracks that happened when Lord Carnarvon and Howard Carter tore him to pieces to take off the jewelry and the crowns and that beautiful, famous golden mask, which was stuck to his face with resins. So he was torn up. However, recent developments have seen that there is a small hole at the base of where the ears would be, which looked like, as I mentioned to you, possibly some kind of a long pointed instrument like our contemporary ice picks.
But
did
they think that used to mummify him?
No. The mummification process was this, that they would have gone through the inside of the nostril to stir up the brain and have it pour out the nose. So they wouldn't need any kind of, the bones inside the nose were broken usually. And that was because of the little whipping thing, whisk, that they did for the nostril, for the brain. But that had nothing to do with this little tiny hole. And it's only been recently found that the hole damaged the nerve system, the connection between the brain and the spinal cord. That must have been a rounded hooked thing that went into his head and his neck. Now, they kind of say in the movie that, yes, his leg festered and he had malaria, encephalitis, which ensues from malaria in Egypt. It was very common, and many people died of that. And they say because he was very sickly anyway, that he only got worse. But I think, and modern Egyptologists think, that many anyway, that I and Horemheb and Ramses, had enough of his nonsense and his decrees and things that were not going to help the kingdom. Remember, they were also at war at the time with the Mitanni and the other races. And, of course, and Hercules will like this, they were also at war with the sea people, which were the Atlanteans. So he wasn't doing anything about it. They, you know, they needed him as king to make decisions, and he wasn't doing that. And I think that the high priest and his court finally made a decision, we have to get rid of this guy. And then there was a power struggle between Horemheb, Ramses I, and I himself. And what happened was they said, well, okay, I'll reign, and then you reign, and then you can reign. That's what history is saying. So there is the possibility that King Tut was actually murdered. But there
well,
is
that
also
was common in the Egyptian court. Cleopatra had her own brother murdered. It
she
was usual to murder inconvenient rulers.
Well, before them, the pyramid builders in the 4th dynasty also knocked off two brothers and a sister so that they could, the second Meneptah and the others could rule after when Khepra was killed. So that the wrong, but you know, they made the one brother out to be a monster in various hieroglyphs. And then you find out later on he was the one that actually enacted the pyramid. So, yes, that happened a great deal. The Ptolemies were not really, they were Greek, not Egyptian, but they followed those Egyptian traditions for murder. That's true. Cleopatra, well, all of the Egyptian pharaohs were incestuous too, yes. Uncle married sister, married cousin, mother married her brother. It went on and on. According to the purity of like Isis and Osiris, so that they did do that. In any case, in the end, Ankhesenamen married I, the high priest. She didn't want to. She wrote letters to all the different other kings and the other outer kingdoms. Please help me. I don't want to marry one of these Egyptian men. I want to have one of your sons and put him on the throne. Whether the letters ever reached where they were going to, we'll never know. But she did marry I. And within the second or third year of his reign, she magically disappeared. I think he did away with her.
How did that happen, I wonder?
Yeah, I think he did away with her. And he married Akhenaten's sister, who, if you ever saw the movie The Egyptian, is called Baketamen, Baket. So she became Pharaoh's wife. And mysteriously died. And then Horemheb became Pharaoh, and then he mysteriously died. And then Ramses became pharaoh, and the whole new dynasty began.
It seems as though being a pharaoh in ancient Egypt wasn't a lot of fun. Whereas,
wasn't good
in many ways, the Egyptians
wasn't
were quite advanced. They
wasn't
did
very
allow,
good for your health.
Well, yes, but the Egyptians did allow women to own property, to own their own businesses, to enact contracts.
They were
good governors. With women.
They were mayors. They were governors. A pharaoh could not rule without his wife. She had to be there. There was never a bachelor pharaoh. She
and
was
she
his right arm.
She tied a beard onto her face, yeah. A fake beard, a gold beard.
She ruled as a man because it was not proper, according to Egyptian traditions, for a woman to rule as pharaoh. So she ruled as a man. She bound her breast. She wore a beard. And she was always seen in public as a pharaoh, not as a queen. She knew how to work the system. She was smart.
But of course Cleopatra was very much a queen and did not obscure the fact. So how did that happen?
Cleopatra was a Ptolemy. The dynastic Egypt was long since gone. They were done. And many other Cleopatras, many of her grandmothers and aunts also ruled for a time as sole queen of Egypt. Julius Caesar, after she killed her brother and then killed off her other brother, put her on the throne as sole ruler of Egypt. She ruled as a pharaoh also. But then remember, they're Greek. And so I guess some of the rules didn't really apply anymore. She was a vassal of Rome. She was a puppet. That's what people forget.
No, not really.
Yeah, she wasn't really the queen. She was the queen because they said she was queen.
Yes.
But
and everyone knows that, and, you know. But now, what do you like so much about this King Tut movie?
The pageantry, the costumes, the actual showing of the rituals that were accurate. His costumes were accurate. You know, as you said, King Tut was actually half Persian. His mother was Megemini. She was the wife of the sister of Nefertiti. She was Persian. And Tutankhamun's grandmother, Lady T, was black. She was Nubian and beautiful. And she looked, I would say, a lot like Leslie Uggams. In fact, I approached Leslie Uggams to join to do that, to play that character in another movie I wrote. And she would have been perfect. If you see Lady T and you see Leslie Uggams, you'll think they were together. But the point is, what was shown as far as costumes and ritual and customs were accurate in the movie, and that I did like. You know, as someone who loved
Lucy. Why
do you
think they got such accuracy in there?
Reading the hieroglyphs and having people like me there to show them what was going on.
How can we know for a fact what was and what was not accurate after all these many years?
Because the Coptics keep a lot of those rituals going still, verbatim, and they're written in the hieroglyph and in Aramaic and in Greek, exactly step by step how things were done. So we do know. We're not guessing there. Egypt is not like many other cultures. They had literature. They had writing. We knew exactly what was going on because it's still written there, and you can see it. And it's drawn in the temple.
And with the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, we learned how to decipher hieroglyphs.
Yes, to some extent, and no, to another extent. Champollion was French, and he added a lot of French words, like nefer, which means beautiful, and he had the word je nefer, which is I'm beautiful. The goddess of the night is Nuit, N-U-I-T, and in French, that's nuit, which means night. So he added a lot of French things to the Egyptian hieroglyphs. We found other things later on through E. Wallace Budge and through many other great Egyptologists that brought more accuracy to the hieroglyphs.
Do you think that this movie is destined to live beyond the next few years and become a classic?
No. No, the acting was mediocre. Ben Kingsley, of course, was Ben Kingsley. But pretty much the rest of the movie was, forgive me for saying, schmaltzy.
Well, isn't it difficult to make a movie that isn't schmaltzy about a young man who had so many health problems and died at 19?
Well, I think we need to do a little more research. You know, I think they jumped the gun in, like you said and like I said, he was the wrong color. It was done, you know, the same as the with Moses and with the gods of Egypt, all these white people playing Arabic and Egyptian and African roles, which were not meant to be. So it was very controversial that way at this point in the time. We know what the Egyptians looked like, and they didn't look like that.
Not at all, no. And we know what King Tut looked like because we have many statues and effigies of him. And he clearly had black features.
But he's still with us, too.
How do you mean he's still with us?
His DNA, his genes, they've taken all that in the museums. We know what he was. We know who he was. You know, we know what he looked like. We also know from his coloring, from the mummy and such, from the skin.
Yes, of course. That's what I mean.
So that's exactly what I mean, too. It was not accurate.
Will we ever see an accurate film? I mean, Claudette Colbert, lovely though she was, is no Cleopatra. Not that Cleopatra was a great beauty, but I mean,
Cleopatra did
not have shaved eyebrows and huge false eyelashes and a red Cupid's bow mouth. And she also wasn't blousy Liz with her hooters sticking out to there and her...
As a matter of fact, Cleopatra went topless most of the time. And she was...
Yeah, but Liz is wearing a corset.
She
definitely
had red
hired
hair.
Someone. Literally, this is true. There was a person on set hired to lace Liz into her corset every day so that she could get that amazing figure of hers. And people complained at the time that, well, there were no zippers in ancient Egypt. I give them a pass. It's a film made for mid-20th century people with a mid-20th century aesthetic. Okay, fine.
But far too inaccurate. The recent Cleopatra, Queen of Egypt, who was black, was ridiculous. Cleopatra
was
100%.
Because
Cleopatra was
100%
Macedonian Greek. She was a Greek, and Greeks were not dark skinned. So, and she never she was a Macedonian Greek. So I was annoyed with that, and many other Egyptologists were. The other shoe was on the other foot. You know, she's not an Egyptian. She had no Egyptian blood or African blood. She was a Greek. But that's not
for, let me
this
ask
isn't
you
about,
this. Why would the Egyptians her? Allow a Greek woman, a Greek dynasty, to rule them if there is no racial link between the rulers and the people?
She had the Roman army behind her. That's why. They couldn't, they tried to knock her out. Her brothers even did. The Julius Caesar and Mark Antony's Roman armies were why she could rule.
Yes, but her ancestors, how did they manage to rule Egypt?
Alexander's armies were there. Ptolemy was a general in Alexander's time. But let's get off Cleopatra. We're on King Tut right now. King Tut's important. That's where we are. And that was the 18th dynasty. Cleopatra was the 32nd dynasty. So we're 1,500 years into the future. Let's not go there. Let's stay with Egypt, with Egyptians.
All right, now let me ask you this. One last question. Do you think the famous Cleopatra, the last independent ruler, more or less independent of Egypt, even knew that King Tut existed since he was so remote in time from her?
No, she didn't. The only reason she would have known is if she'd gone to the Temple of Amun in Thebes and looked on the list of the kings. And you know what? He wasn't there. He was eliminated.
Why?
He was wiped out. Horemheb and Ramesses and I, all those pharaohs, they wiped him out because he was Akhenaten's son.
And so politically incorrect.
It was, yes, he was. So a lot of the pharaohs did that. They would replace their buildings. You know, Ramses II was famous for taking credit for buildings he didn't build. And so was Thutmosis III, a nephew of King Tut, actually. So they all did that. It was horrible, you know, but that goes on all the time. I mean, it even happened in the Napoleonic times, or Louis XIV. They all did that. It wasn't the
Here's
last one.
Here's a question that's out of left field. And it has to do with Egyptology, but now they say that there's no time outside of the third dimension, which is the dimension we live in, as we all know, which means that it's entirely possible for you to be Michael here in the 21st century and to die as Michael and then have a life in ancient Egypt as your next life. What do you think of that?
I think they all work together at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein said linear time doesn't exist.
Right.
So I guess we're all doing the same different movies in the same costumes. So I guess we're going to have to look at it that way.
Yeah,
Hercules,
sure.
What do you think?
One second.
Okay,
I'm on the screen. Basically, again, the more you experiment with altered states, the more you become convinced that time isn't linear. And ultimately and eventually, everything is in the here and now. And our experience of time is something that limits us to a particular path and way of looking at things. So I'm not really sure. I know that we are what we are. And we express it here on the third dimension in terms of time and space. But whether those are absolutes, I don't believe so, but I don't know.
Now, did the Egyptians believe in reincarnation?
Yes, because of Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
They also believe that for a period of 72 years that they would be able to communicate with their relatives and their families. All the tombs had false doors where they left food and offerings for that the passed on person. So they were trying to communicate that way. So they did believe that, but they also believed after that they would enter a dimension other than this world, and then if they were of a certain energy, they would return back to this world.
Did they ever think that, well, you know, like the Dalai Lama, did they ever think, well, this pharaoh is actually the reincarnation of the last pharaoh or the pharaoh of 100 years ago?
There is some theory that that was believed. It depends on which hieroglyphs you read and from which dynasties. Different dynasties had different thoughts and beliefs. Even within different dynasties, there were different thoughts and beliefs. You know, Hatshepsut was a pharaoh. She was a queen, but she was a pharaoh. But she believed that she was the reincarnation of her grandfather. And so that she was a woman.
Amazing. That's wonderful.
She felt very, from what I read from her, she felt very connected to her grandfather, that she was, you know, she knew about things that she could not possibly have known about had she not lived that life.
Well, and many great seers, such as Edgar Cayce, said it was often the case that people came back into the same family.
Yes, that's true. I also know from a Ptolemaic life of mine that my father and my sister were part of that past life with me, and that we are, again, you know, after 2,000-somewhat years, we're family again. We were family again. And I think I learned
from
myself. Well,
haven't you been family over and over again? I mean, you didn't have to wait 2,000 years, did you? You might have been family in the Renaissance or in 18th century France or something.
I know that I've known you before. I know that I've known
Hercules. Oh, I know that too, yeah.
And I know I've known Hercules
before. I feel it,
yeah.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely.
I believe that I've known Hercules for thousands of years. You know, it was just too easy to be friends with him. And
exactly.
You too.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely, 1,000%. I couldn't agree more.
I'll put you an interesting case. When I was given the choice in school of Spanish, Italian, or French, I chose French. And my teachers were amazed because I spoke the language early on in my learning of it, as though I had already spoken it before. And I know why, after doing various past life regressions, because I was French. It's something.
Well, there's
it's
a story, as you know, of the actor Glenn Ford having a past life regression and speaking a little-known dialect of French, little-known to the people of the recent past, you know, the 20th century. And they asked him, an expert on French, well, what is he saying? And the expert said, well, it's a provincial dialect in use during the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. It turned out he'd been a soldier then. I mean, that if that isn't proof positive of reincarnation, I don't know what is.
With myself, if I may, I knew the symbol, the Eye of Horus, Utshat. I knew what it was before I ever learned what it was. Confirm what it was before I ever looked at it and knew what it was. I knew that that was a symbol that was something to do with my past life. I knew it was something I knew about. I also knew when I looked at Elizabeth Taylor that Cleopatra didn't look like that. I said to my uncle, who was mortified because I looked at Liz, I said, she doesn't look like that. And I pointed to a box of Antony and Cleopatra's cigars where it showed her with gold hair, a rather heavy-set, zoftig kind of a woman laying on a couch, nothing like Liz Taylor. I said, she looked more like this.
Which is a 19th century representation of Cleopatra, yeah.
But I said to my uncle, but she had a big nose. And, you know, then I saw this thing on the series Rome, where they had this scarecrow girl who had no breasts and smoking a hookah and a hash pipe. And I thought, she never did that. And I was enraged. My inner spirits were saying to me, this is not right. And I felt the same way when I heard King Tut was supposed to be dying of encephalitis, knowing in my heart and maybe in my soul that he was murdered. And I knew I was part of it. and I thought it was justified. Now, as a spirit, I thought that was something that helped the country to get rid of this little monster. And in the movie, they do it because the Pharaoh, who was a scribe, was ambitious. And that's true. He was a part of the dynasty, but he was never going to be Pharaoh. He wasn't royal. And Horemheb was a general, a cheesemaker's son, which they show in another movie called The Egyptian. But he was. And, you know, Ramses was a general, that's all. And he came up from the ranks.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Do you think it's fair to entrust a teenage boy, however intelligent and well-trained he might be, with such sweeping, awesome power? Because there are lessons that only time teaches. And no matter how intelligent a young person is, that person is still a young person and has yet to experience the ups and downs of life and, you know, the many nuanced things that happen to us all that give us wisdom. So really, you know, it seems unfair to call Tut a monster when in fact he was probably, you know, a teenage boy. What do you think?
They thought of him as a spoiled little monster, the governors and the generals and such. And they thought that he would be a milksop, that he would, you know, do dance to whatever music they played. They planned to rule through him. And when he started to fight back, that's when I know that they started to figure out what they were going to do to eliminate him.
Well, now let me ask you this. Why did he start to fight back? Were there other factions advising him to fight back and telling him how to fight back?
Yes. I believe Nefertiti was still alive and that she was acting as his, well, she wasn't his mother, but she was his, you know, his aunt and possibly godmother. And she took over the nurturing of him, and I think she started to tell him what to do. And I think that's why she disappears from history, that she was removed also. And so they have this boy that they thought was malleable, and he turned out at puberty and such to fight back. And they were like, well, this we can't have. We wanted someone who would just be a bobblehead doll and a puppet ruler. And that's why they put him on the throne. They had Akhenaten, who was a nut, who bankrupted the kingdom, starved most of the people in Egypt, and killed anyone who didn't believe what he believed. So
was
here they got...
Was his successor amenable to advice? Or did he also perform in a headstrong, independent way, which got him killed?
Well, he was 9 years old, and at that point he was a frightened little boy, and he
No,
listened.
No, I mean Tut's successor.
Tut's successor was the Grand Vizier AI, the one who was pushing the buttons behind King Tut.
Which is you in a previous life.
Yes, it was, and that's how I know he was murdered. I was there. I know what happened. And when I first saw AI's ring in the Metropolitan Museum, I knew that was my ring. It belonged to me. You can't tell the Metropolitan Museum that, but it was true. I knew... I bought a copy of it, and it fit my finger perfectly. How's that for scary?
Yeah, well, but what do you think?
Do I think I was a corrupt politician? Yes, I do. I don't think he was a very good person.
Is there any other
kind? Well, for thousands of years, no.
Having been in politics myself, you know, I know how extraordinarily corrupt and cynical they can be.
Well, you were trying to do your best, and you were trying to do what was right for the community, and I applaud you for that. But
thank
you, saw
you
the
but ultimately, the forces of darkness in politics always win, which is very sad, but it is what it is.
Well, you know, a little over 300 years ago, we tried to overthrow a politically corrupt government and move it out of the country. And then what would you say? Not too long after, we had another government that we created. And after a while, well, look at it now. But so that was what happened with King Tut. They saw that Akhenaten was corrupt and awful, And so to prevent that from happening again, the high priest and the generals and his grandmother, Lady Tai, and, well, she didn't want to help, but she did, Nefertiti, helped the revolution.
Let me ask you a question. Was anyone in favor of King Tut? Did anyone, you know, make Egypt great again, a hat on or something?
In the beginning, when he took the throne, the entire nation was cheering because he changed his name, or they changed his name, from Tutankhaten to Tutankhamun, which is that Amun, the god Amun, is pleased, the living image of Amun, you know, rather than the living image of Aten. So they were pleased. And his girlfriend, or his wife, became from Ankhensepaten. She became Ankhensenamun. So all of them changed their names back to the state deity Amun, rather than the other state deity Aten.
Which his father had insisted be crammed down the people's throats.
But that's the point. Egypt had always had a polytheistic, and also you believe what you believed. It was okay if you worshipped this one or if she worshipped that one. It didn't matter. Egyptians were very liberal that way. Akhenaten was not. You were to worship what he said, when he said, and where it was done was this. You worshipped him and Nefertiti, and then they would worship the god for you. You were not permitted to worship.
Sounds oddly like the Catholic Church, that the Pope is the conduit to God, and you will do as you are told, or else. That is very much the Catholic Church's position, you know?
But you're allowed to pray to God yourself. In Akhenaten's case, no, you were not. You'd be arrested. If you were making hymns and chants that were not in his presence, you could be executed.
Well, that is obviously why he was done away with, and ultimately, I mean, you cannot rip. It's like in the late 60s, they declared that the saints were invalid, many saints were invalid, and this absolutely drove gung-ho Catholics crazy. I was going to Catholic school at the time, and I didn't care what happened, but a lot of people were just up in arms. How dare they do away with St. Christopher, with, you know, St. Cosmo, St. this, St. that. No doubt, in an even stronger way, the Egyptian populace of that time reacted that way when King Tut's father chose to make it a monotheistic state and do away with the deities that they had worshipped forever.
The interesting thing is that when the Catholic Church realized who St. Christopher really was, that's why they stripped him. St. Christopher was actually Hercules.
There you go.
Yeah, so Hercules was the reason that saint was disbarred, because he wasn't. And then they should have taken Bridget, because goddess Bridget, the queen, the saint Bridget, is the Irish mother goddess. She was never a mortal being. She still isn't a mortal being. And I thought that was extremely funny. So Patrick just said, in order to get people to worship more Catholic Church, they would canonize, which is the same thing, a goddess and make her a saint. You know, Saint Olaf.
Yeah, no, I know.
And I don't
mean
the one
funny.
From...
You should say that we all knew one another. This is so true. There's another guest of Hercules named Pamela. She's great.
Yes.
She's very intuitive, and she discovered that she and I had a life where we knew each other, I don't know, 15 million years ago, something like that, or 1,000 years ago. And I it's very strange to have come upon my soul group and I have so many familiar presences, not necessarily faces, because naturally we've all changed over millennia and adopted many different bodies, but to have so many people I feel very at home and comfortable with because I have known them many a time before.
I always say that you always meet the same similar cast of peoples, and to see what you will do with that life this time. I think that is one of the higher forces' plan. What do you do with this time? You're playing another play. Yeah, what will you learn this time? No, what will you learn this time? And I think that, you know, King Tut at that time, I don't think that he, you know, he found his true voice, his true self. I think that, you know, he wasn't allowed to think what he thought. He was only allowed, until he was 15 or 16 years old, to take whatever they told him to. And he would appear on the lip of the temple, the palace, and people went crazy because he was this beautiful young boy king. And, you know, he was a symbol of the hope of the future. And then he wanted to go back into the past, into a past the Egyptians didn't want anymore. They didn't want to worship Aten. They wanted to worship as they pleased, as they had always done. And
the
so,
many the many gods and goddesses that they had known forever. Yes.
Their father deity at that time was Amun, the chief god. That would be Zeus in Greece. Amun was the same. And so, you know, they wanted to go back to what they knew. And here he was thinking, oh, you know what? Maybe my father didn't have the wrong idea after all. And that was more than they could stand. And so they say on one of his hunting expeditions, the chariot hit a rock or a wall or something, and he flipped over and he cracked his very delicate...
Maybe someone loosened the carriage wheels to make sure that happened.
Yes.
And then artfully placed a rock right where the carriage would come.
Something,
you know?
Something. But they also think that they had gotten to Ankhesenamun and said, look, you've got to stop this. And they think that also she helped poison him because she was also promised things. This is what goes on in the movie. They show that she's unfaithful. I don't know that that's true. I think that was Hollywood because she wanted very much when he died, after he died, to marry another of the Hittite prince or a Midiani prince. Or a Nubian. She wanted anybody but I, the Pharaoh, the high priest, I. She didn't trust him, and she had every reason not to trust him. He was extremely politically corrupt.
She sent missives to every kingdom she knew of, saying, please send me your son, any son, I don't care. I'll marry a two-year-old, just not this man, you know?
Anybody but this guy. She knew he killed him. She knew it. I'm convinced. And she was afraid. And, you know, Nefertiti, her mother, disappeared mysteriously. They found a mummy recently that has a smashed face and a ripped-out stomach, and they believe that's Nefertiti. The bone structure...
Which is in line with, since her name was the beautiful one has come, malice would cause them to smash her face, you know,
I think that's exactly right. I agree with you. I think it's exactly right. Because she was beautiful, and because they hated her so much, because she was beautiful on the outside, but very mean and corrupt on the inside. She was much like her husband. They were zealots. They had their own way of doing things, and it was to be their way or nothing. You know, the pharaohs weren't that way. They kept the religion, they kept the government, they kept things as it was because they knew it worked. It was 7,000 years.
Was Egypt a kind of democracy? Or was it very much an autocracy?
I hate to interrupt, but we have around 5 minutes left, so I'd love for you guys to share how people can contact you and share some of the awesome things that you're doing.
Very simply, you can get me by mkwaterman@icloud.com. You can write to me now at Michael K. Waterman, 1699 Chatham, Chatham, Parkway, apartment 1523A, Savannah, Georgia, 31405. You can get me mkwaterman@icloud.com or phone a wizard on Facebook also. I will respond. I have all the things I'm working with. And you can get me on my phone number, which is 516-650-3691. I'll be glad to help you.
And you have Phone a Wizard, and you also, you're creating ritual implements like staffs and...
There is a company also called Ushabti Limited. I'm actually looking at two of my Ushabtis here. I make custom Ushabtis. They are a replica of the person that I'm working with, and it's a spirit statue, a spirit, how will I put it, an encouragement to use the astral and spiritual energies to go forward and accomplish what you need. It's a prop, I would call it in a way, but a very strong one.
And they look amazing from what I've seen.
Thank you. I'm looking at two of them right now.
And Diana, how about you? How can people tune in?
Well, people can contact me via You Hercules, and they can see you and Michael and many of the other guests, Brian Walker, for example, hopefully Pam in the near future, on my television show, The Diana Monfort Show, which airs on Manhattan Neighborhood Network television on Thursday night, 10 p.m. New York time. And look forward to seeing, Michael, a friend of yours, Moshe Moses, saw you on my show, and she says hi.
Tell her I said hello.
Okay, great. So, fascinating. Hercules, you do so many interesting things that no one does or even thinks of doing. I mean, you're really amazing, you know that?
Well, thank you. Thank you for your kind words. I think you guys are amazing as well. And I'm happy that our paths have crossed and that we're doing things together. And I have a few things up my sleeve for the months ahead. I've shared some of them with you guys individually, but we're going to be moving on one of them. It has a clunky title. It's called Sword and Sandals, Superheroes, Strange Science, and Outer Space. So that pretty much tells you what it's about. And we'll be starting with Hercules Against the Moon Men and Giants of Metropolis. And we're very fortunate to have Bella Cortez, who starred in the second motion picture. And so we're going to be doing panels like we do with the UFOs, except
I love her. I've done two interviews. She's great. I love her.
Yes, she is. She's fantastic. And so we have a lot of really interesting things planned in the months ahead. We're working towards putting together a school called the Athenaeum. In antiquity, an Athenaeum was a combination between a college and a museum, kind of. So we're trying to pull that together. So this is going to be a very busy and productive year, and I'm honored to have you both on board.
Thank you.
And we're honored to be on board. Thanks.
And any last words you'd like to leave with our audience tonight?
Only thing I can say is that I'm excited to be working with the next couple of things. You all know that I am building my online temple, and you're all welcome. We have degree systems, and I have different books I can send to people. They're my reading list, and I also have the Per-Ankh, which is the School of Life, and the Per-Niteru, which is the temple.
And we'll be covering
And my final words
Go ahead.
Are that Michael has helped me tremendously. He gave me a crystal that improved my life. He gave me a beautiful wand that he made that, I mean, Michael is for real. He's really good. And I can't endorse him enough. He's a great wizard.
I agree. And on that note, thank you very much again. And thanks to our listeners. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you patiently waited in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everyone, and thanks again.
Good night, and thank you.
Good night. Thank you.